Oxford English Dictionary defines happiness as good fortune or good luck in life generally or in a particular affair. Success, prosperity, or the state
of... Anastasia, is this your way of saying that our topic for today is happiness?
Yes, you guessed it, Rhiannon.
Then let's not delay it any further and jump straight into it. The Science
Basement! Hello and welcome to the Science Basement podcast, a podcast for those who love all things science. I'm your host for today, Anastasia.
And I'm your co-host, Rhiannon.
As you already know from our introduction or even the name of the episode, today we're going to talk about happiness. What it is, what it means to different people, and whether Finland, the happiest country in the world, may not be as happy. To talk about it, we invited social psychologist Jennifer Di Paola. She's a fresh doctoral graduate in social psychology at the University of Helsinki, now a postdoc, and soon a happy mother. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello.
Nice having you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start off by covering what is happiness. What does it mean to different people?
Okay, well, there are a lot of different definitions for happiness, even within social sciences, and accordingly, also different ways to measure happiness. But mainly, happiness research has drawn upon the distinction between hedonic and eudaimonic happiness. So with hedonic happiness, we mean a high frequency of positive emotions and a low frequency of negative emotions. And then we can also mean high levels of life satisfactions, which can mean satisfaction, contentment with life in general, or also with specific domains of life. And then psychologists like to use the construct of subjective well-being, which is a composition, like putting all these things together. So frequent positive emotions, a low frequency of negative emotion, and high levels of life satisfaction. And there you have happiness for psychologists. And then there is a second tradition, which we call eudaimonic happiness. And that has more to do with the extent to which you can consider your life to be meaningful or engaging. So it's another way to look at happiness.
So there seems to be certainly many layers to happiness.
Indeed.
And it's not just like one tiny thing that brings you joy, for example, but it's a whole complex of things that compose your happiness and the feeling of happiness. But it seems like very often people confuse the definition of happiness with satisfaction and joy. Could you please explain what would be the difference between them?
Yes, and I, on the defense of people, it's not that they are confused. It's just that this different construct are used interchangeably by scientists themselves. So no wonder people are confused, because they will just use different constructs and call it happiness. So what life satisfaction is a cognitive judgment. So it's an evaluation that a person does regarding how content they are with life in general, overall, or with specific areas. For example, how content you are with your work, with your family situations, and so on. Whereas joy is a positive affect, so it's something more transitory that you can experience more or less often.
And just to come in now quickly, so with these definitions coming around, I just wanted to follow up and ask, between countries and cultures, is there a kind of difference in the happiness there, and how is this kind of accounted for? Is there some common parameters?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. And usually when it comes to measuring happiness across countries, scientists are mainly interested in the levels of happiness. But there is like a smaller niche of studies that have looked at how happiness is made sense of in different cultures and among different countries. And there are both differences and similarities. So in terms of differences, when you leave participants the freedom to define happiness in their own words, different participants from different countries will use different terms. So, like, for example, people from the east part of the world, like India, they will be less prone compared to, for example, people from New Zealand to use high arousal terms, meaning, like, for example, happiness is being excited, elated, overjoyed. They will tend to use these terms less, and they will prefer to use terms like being content, serene. So this is one of the differences. Then, in terms of similarities, it seems that no matter which country you come from, harmony and balance is something that is at the very core of how happiness is defined. And maybe one more thing that really makes us all very similar across the globe is the fact that social relationships are always cited as a universally mentioned ingredient for happiness. So that's true no matter where you're from.
Okay, so as I understand, the way that people kind of the words that you used to describe their happiness can be quite different, but the components that make them happy kind of tend to stay the same throughout cultures, which is very interesting. It kind of actually makes a lot of sense because I guess in different languages as well, different words have different emphasis as well.
Yes, in different languages and also across time, there can be changes. So the changes are not necessarily like horizontal or geographical. They can also be generational, or they can be more linked to the passage of time.
So then, looking at the opposite of that, what is unhappiness? Is this a thing? Is it kind of the opposite of happiness, or what would you define this as?
Yeah, well, in one of my studies, I asked that to participants. So first I asked them to give me the five words that first came to their mind when thinking of the word happiness. And then I asked them to do the same, not with unhappiness, but actually I asked them to give me the first five words they could think of with the stimulus term opposite of happiness, just to see what they would come up with. The interesting finding, of course, like there were lots of different terms. Loneliness was very common, surprisingly. But I think the most interesting finding was that there was much more agreement regarding the words chosen for describing happiness and less agreement regarding opposite of happiness. So if you're familiar with Anna Karenina's Tolstoy, all happy families are alike, and each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. That seems to hold a kernel of truth also when asking participants directly about unhappiness.
And what really surprises me, or maybe not even surprises me, but that what I find very interesting is that there's a very common feature between the unhappiness and unhappiness or absence of happiness is the social aspect. So just to emphasize again the key of social interactions in your feeling of happiness and satisfaction.
That is a good observation. So the same, yeah, if social relationship is a universally mentioned ingredient, main ingredient for happiness, then it does make sense that loneliness is described as the opposite of happiness. Yeah.
But before we move on further, just general wondering, what motivated you to conduct your research to begin with?
I think it's just unfolded in front of me, really, because I have a background in clinical psychology. So in my master's studies, I delved very deep into the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders. So I was studying depression, anxiety, mainly mental disorders. And then I happened to move to Finland, and people were joking a lot. They were saying, like, oh, you will have plenty of clients, as many as you want, because people here are so depressed. And then I looked up at statistics, and in fact there are very high level of depressions in this country. But then I also looked at how Finland fares in other statistics, and it seemed to be doing very well in the World Happiness Report already when I moved here back in 2011. So I was in a way intrigued by this paradox, and it seemed like an interesting paradox to try to unpack. And then decided to move from clinical psychology to social psychology and see how lay people understand happiness and also how they understand happiness science and statistics regarding happiness.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up that, well, even when you moved here, that Finland was seen as a quite a happy country in the happiness index. Because when I moved here nearly 2 years ago now, and all everyone says to me, oh, you're in the happiest country in the world. It's always mentioned to me. Even recently, some friends came to visit and we went on one of these walking tours around the city. And even the tour guides use this as kind of, oh, it's the happiest country in the world. And then, you know, people are kind of thinking, oh, okay. And then I think people come here and they kind of realize that the index doesn't actually mean, well, I guess I can ask you what's the kind of difference between our kind of social thinking of what happiness is and this, how this index works, because I think, as you say, Finland has high like levels of depression. So then you would think, looking at this index, oh well, how is it happiest in the world then? And I think this is quite an interesting concept, that how this index works and why it's given, you know, a lot of weight, and is this correct or not?
Yeah, well, again, part of the confusion, I think, stems from the fact that there are so many ways to measure happiness. And the way the World Happiness Report measures happiness is through the country ladder, which measures life satisfaction. So this very limited aspect of happiness. So they ask participants how satisfied you are with your life on a scale from 0 to 10. That's it. The ranking is based on then on the participants' response to this one single question. And there you've got your ranking and Finland's top position. So the ranking does not reflect positive or negative emotions or how frequently they are being experienced. And this unfortunately generates a lot of confusion, because we've seen that the general public, like your friends, have a much more rich and complex idea of happiness, which includes positive emotions, maybe low frequency of negative emotions, meaningful life, or even the opportunity to live an interesting and eventful life. And instead, the World Happiness Report measures a very limited aspect of happiness, the extent to which we feel satisfied with our life. And then if I can still add something regarding the depression paradox, I think that it's also important, well, one, to keep in mind that the World Happiness Report measures life satisfaction only and not positive negative affects. And then secondly, the fact that Finland is in a has a very specific way of diagnosing depression. And that's something that the World Health Organization keeps reminding us as well. Look, when you interpret statistics that show you different rates of depressions across country, take also into consideration that different countries have different ways to diagnose depression, to offer treatment, different accessibility level to mental health care, also different cultural taboos around depression. So that might, in a way, contribute to the high level of depression, the fact that the mental health care system is more accessible in Finland.
That's extremely interesting. But you mentioned that these ratings, that these reports that they perform is primarily measuring satisfaction. But now in your research, you measured the actual levels of happiness. Am I correct?
That was like a little bit of a trick question, of a trick item that I had in one of my studies, where I asked participants to rate their life, to rate how happy they are with their life from 1 to 10. But actually what I was interested in was not their actual answer, but their elaboration on the scale. So after presenting them with the scale, I asked them, what would have to change in your life so that you could answer 10 if you haven't answered 10? That was actually what I was interested in. I wasn't going to measure happiness as such, but more like their understanding of the scale, or like their opinion and their representation of a scale.
Okay, so that's very interesting. So you're kind of looking at extension of this happiness index. It's not just the satisfaction, but it's actually why they feel that. So what results did you find from this?
In terms of level of happiness, I think that the average was 8, so I would say pretty high. But then if I have to mention something that really stood out and that was interesting, was the fact that many of the participants were challenging the method of using a scale. They thought that it was too crude. They thought that you cannot answer 10 necessarily, no matter what changes you would make in your life. 10 is like a bogus number. You'll never reach it because it doesn't exist, because happiness is transitory. So that's just what I was after. And that's just, I very much agree with my participants. Measuring something so complex with a crude, very simple, single item scale is very, very reductive.
And among the people who answered that they may reach 10, what were the parameters that they mentioned that would help them reach it?
So they either mention changes that have to do with the circumstances, or then more often they felt like more in control of changing something about themselves. So I think that that made them feel like more empowered. So it's easier to change rather than if you, for example, feel lonely, you can say that, okay, I should be making more friends. If I had more friends, I'd be happier. Or then you can see the way like, okay, I just need to learn to live with myself and to feel empowered even when I'm alone. So that's more a change that has to do, it's an inner change that has to do with your attitude. And usually those people were more likely to say that they could reach a higher number if they could make these changes.
Just a follow-up question on this. So I was wondering kind of what age group did you sample? Just out of interest, did this kind of change, like the answers on age? Did you see some kind of change in the
Yes.
response?
So I actually compared two groups. The first group were female high school students from 16 to 18 years old. And then the second group included older women between 29 and 34 years of age to see. Like I sort of wanted to capture a little bit the millennials and the Generation Z and see whether there are any differences. Maybe I can elaborate a little bit on the differences that I found. Of course, there were mainly similarities because we're talking about, I mean, after all, these cohorts are very close together. So we're not talking about children and older people. We're talking about young women in general and belonging to the same culture, to the same city. But there were also some interesting differences. For example, younger women use more enjoyment terms to describe happiness. So, for example, music, sun, summer, sports, warmth. They were very popular words that were associated spontaneously with happiness. And you could clearly see these words disappearing among the older women. And there were words, new words that I did not see among the high school girls, like, for example, children. And it's completely intuitive that something that it does not belong to the realm of a 16-year-old, but it's something that can sort of be more linked to happiness when you are in your 30s.
More of a breezy definition when it comes to younger age.
Yes, exactly. More to do with enjoyment, more to do with high arousal terms, more to do with fun.
But when we talk about younger generation, the first thing also that comes to my mind is our obsessiveness with social media and internet. I was wondering if it gives any effect on the way we perceive happiness, because I feel like oftentimes we also depend on what other people think. And again, like here falls this aspect falls under the what you earlier mentioned, the social part of happiness. Did you look into this as well?
Yes, perhaps not directly, but indirectly, I have been conducting research using naturally occurring data from the internet. I think that the internet and social media impact how we represent happiness. And that's true also for millennials. I don't think that that's an issue that has to do with generations that I think that we simply use different kind of platforms compared to younger people that we probably spend as much time and are just as much impacted by it. In terms of how it impacts happiness, well, of course, platforms, especially image-based platforms such as Instagram, are very much based on appearances. You want to be liked. You want your life to look attractive. So you're constantly balancing between looking attractive and also genuine. And there is not much space for sharing experiences about failure or sadness. You want to look cool. So that might impact the way in which we represent happiness. And then I think that the real negative impacts comes to, it's more linked to comparing your life with this kind of unattainable perfect life that you keep seeing, even though you do that yourself. So you should know that it's not a very faithful portrayal of what that person is probably experiencing, but still it's very easy to fall into the trap of comparing oneself with others. And that's the perfect recipe for unhappiness. It really sours everything good there is in your life if you start comparing yourself negatively with others. And unfortunately, social media are a very fruitful territory for that.
I just wanted to ask kind of an opposite question to see if you had any experience of this. But have you ever had anyone that's had some sort of positive influence from social media on their happiness? Because I guess in some cases it could actually be kind of useful for people to see other people who might not, like, they might not see in their daily lives or kind of have this kind of representation. And I wondered if you had any experience of this, because it's not really talked about so much in the realms of discussing social media.
Yeah, it is true that usually when you talk about social media, you always talk about the negative aspect. But then, of course, it depends a lot on how social media is used. If it's used, for example, to complement face-to-face interaction, then especially when we were going through the lockdown with COVID and all, actually, I think that it's been really beneficial to keep like a high level of positive emotion engagement and just as an alternative way to keep nurturing social contacts. And then beside that, I've been interested in my research in inspirational messages that you find on social media. So I've been in one study, for example, I've looked at happiness memes. So memes that give advice on how to become happier. And those can sort of cheer people up. I mean, they spread positivity. Of course, they spread a very condensed form of positivity, which is sometimes unrealistic, but it can also have like a positive effect. And actually there can be very important truths in this very condensed forms of advice on how to reach happiness.
Did the main parameters that went through most of the memes, for example, did they reflect also some of the findings you saw by interviewing women in your study? Because usually they reflect what people actually, like how people actually define happiness.
Yes, and I'll tell you what, not only did they reflect cultural understanding of happiness that I found in previous studies, but they also reflected scientific findings. We know, for example, there are tons of experiments about gratitude and about the effect that will have in your happiness, especially in long-lasting happiness. And we get the exact same advice from memes in a very condensed form. So I don't think that they're necessarily banal. I think that, well, sometimes there is to oversimplify things because there is only so much space that you can use in a meme. And also they have this kind of maybe over positive message sometimes, like God, like you can be happy if you just want to. And that puts like a lot of responsibility on the single individual. But then on the other hand, there are some advice that really overlap with what experts in happiness are saying.
That's a good reminder to check memes every now and then. There might be something helpful in them too, not just fun.
Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to quickly say as well, just staying on this topic of social media, do you think there's some sort of, I guess, kind of scale with the use of social media? Because nowadays, like even within the past 2 years with the introduction of like TikTok and Instagram Reels and stuff, I think it kind of can almost be like an overload. It's not necessarily on like the reflection of the people you're seeing, but so much, but kind of more for the kind of time spent. Because I know for me anyway, on these social media platforms, sometimes it's like the algorithm is there to kind of keep you on the platform. And then it's kind of not necessarily the perception of how the people you're looking at change your social media, but actually maybe how much time you're spending on it could kind of influence your happiness. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, but it just kind of crossed my mind now to kind of talking about how social media is also changing and if this is something you've thought about or not.
Yes, no, I agree. They are designed to, and like all the updates, I feel, are also designed to keep you there for longer. I mean, reels have been my undoing. I myself spend way too much time looking at reels. And yeah, I think in the end, it's also about not necessarily maybe how much time you spend, but also like what kind of value and meaning you assign to that time. Is it mm-hmm. something that you really need for relaxing? Is it something that is gradually replacing face-to-face interaction? Because I think that, for example, Instagram is going a lot in that direction. It was first more about friends, right? About people that you might be following, even in the, you follow people that you might know in real life. And now algorithms are trying to present you with just random people. So it's kind of like going very much in the opposite direction of complementing face-to-face interaction. So yes, I think that then when it starts impacting how much time and energy you have for dedicating to social support, then that's dangerous then. I agree.
But now we've discussed what happiness means to other people and how it's perceived in social media and etc. But what does it mean to you? And has your research changed your own perception on happiness?
Well, definitely. I think that it could be that now I know too much about this topic to be unbiased and, like, how can I say, genuine and give like a genuine lay answer. I think that definitely I have come to think of happiness as something more complex. I've understood that it captures very different aspects of life. Maybe one thing that I have taken with me from the science, from academia into my personal life that I've really implemented in my life is remembering how much enjoying small things and appreciating moments really counts, like what a difference it makes. And it might sound as a cliche, it's something that you might find in academic journals, you might find it in a memes, you might hear that like from grandmas, but I think that that's at least something that I've taken with me from all my research.
Yeah, I was going to say, based on this kind of taking the happiness out of small things, it's interesting, since I moved to Finland, I definitely noticed this more with the weather. I know everybody complains about the weather here, but I think since being somewhere where it's so cold over the winter, even the summer brings me more happiness when it's here, because I know that it's going to be so cold so soon, and vice versa. Actually, like, even this summer it's hot for longer, and I was kind of thinking, oh, it'd be nice to have a bit cooler. Like, I found this quite interesting reflecting on how I feel about this, because I think of course you have to have the movement and different people react differently to the weather, but I think for me, because I'm from the UK, so it's not so different, but it made me really kind of appreciate the different weather, which is, I guess, something very simple that, you know, everyone has around them. So yeah, it's quite a interesting point you make there.
That's a very, very good example.
All right, the discussion so far has been extremely interesting, and we have actually a few more very intriguing questions submitted from our listeners. And actually, a side note for our listeners who may not be familiar, we've just introduced this new section where you can submit your questions to us via Instagram about the upcoming episodes, which will inform you about there. So if you have anything you would be interested to ask on the topic, feel free to submit. But we did receive and selected three questions from the listeners, as I said. So first one is happiness something you can train?
Very, very good and applied question. Yes. The good news is it is. And I would recommend to train all these different kinds of happiness that we've seen simultaneously. And I would work in four directions. So nurturing relationships, since social support is so important, nurture relationship in real life. One good way to start off with is practicing acts of kindness. Just do something for the people you love. Then savor life's joys. So the small things, just as we were talking, exercise gratitude. Then do more activities that truly engage you. So that will go more in the direction of working in, with your eudaimonic happiness. So your meaning of life. Find something that truly means something for you and keep at it. And then finally, try not to sour your happiness. So going back with to social media, avoid overthinking and especially social comparison.
Oh, I hope everybody's taking notes. Otherwise, they can also go back to re-listen to this part. Sounds very useful indeed.
I was just going to say, follow up on your answer there. It's some good tips because I think people might be overwhelmed when someone says, "Can you train happiness?" But the things you've given are quite achievable things, which I think people kind of forget that they can do these things. And I guess one thing that comes into this, which I guess we don't have time to go into completely, but work-life balance, which is always a thing that everyone struggles with, I think. But I think it's important to kind of know these things very simply, because then it becomes kind of like not such a daunting task to think, oh, I'm not happy with anything. And you can just do things like you say, like just give some kindness to people you love, and then you'll feel automatically that little bit better and make this kind of like a habit, not just a one-off thing.
Exactly.
Happiness is clearly something both internal and external, so it comes from your outside environment as much as it comes from within yourself. The next one is, how can one build a long-lasting feeling of happiness? Because being sad sometimes overpowers most of the time.
So we're talking about a person who is experiencing more negative emotions than positive. So, like, how to.
Yeah, I think it's just that feeling of happiness as this very sharp sensation doesn't always exactly something we pay attention to, maybe. I think that's what they meant in this question.
Yes. Yeah. So it seems like a situation of sadness being more frequent than experiencing joy and positive emotions. Well, I would first of all remember that experiencing positive emotions frequently is highly correlated with life satisfaction. So if being sad is the most frequent feeling most of the time, it would be reasonable then to ask oneself about how satisfied we are with life overall, maybe with different spheres of life. Is there something that we can change in specific areas? And are these changes something that we have control over? Or are they changes that would demand a more structural change at the societal level? So if it's something that I can change myself, how? And if it's something that I have no control over, how can I seek for help? Because unlike what memes say on the internet, it's not true that you decide whether you can be happy and only you can. It's only about your attitude. No, there are some things that have more to do with societal issues. There are injustices, and there are some things that needs to change, that need to change also from the outside. There is only so much that you can do with your positive attitude. It's not only your responsibility. You also are entitled to ask for help and to demand changes when you feel that you're experiencing an injustice or something.
Fighting for your own happiness, basically.
Yes, and also remembering that it's not exclusively your responsibility.
So, to finish up the questions from the audience, how does happiness relate to slash contrast with fulfillment of momentary pleasures?
Well, I think that it goes back to those labels and definitions that we were discussing at the beginning of the episode. So when we talk about momentary pleasure, they are transitorial, they have a beginning and an end. So we're more talking about affects, positive emotions, and they are just a component of happiness. And happiness is more of a broader concept, which we've seen includes many other aspects, life satisfactions, low frequency of negative emotions, and also meaning of life and so on. So think broader when you think of happiness.
Thank you very much. And just before we finish, is there any take-home message that you would like to say, something that you would like the listeners to remember? And
Well, if I had to sum this up, I would say remember that happiness is complex. There are different ways to assess it. As you can see from the World Happiness Report, what researchers claim when they're measuring happiness usually capture only one aspect, and usually us people are much better at giving a more complex and a more multifaceted assessment of happiness. So if you want to assess happiness in your own life, you want to know how happy you are, ask yourself, am I satisfied with life in general? Am I satisfied with specific areas of life? Am I more joyful or sad on average? Do I feel my life is meaningful? So ask yourself many different questions. And then, according to your answer, see if there is something that needs to be changed. The change could be about the circumstances, or it could even just be about your attitude.
So it seems that we all need to do a bit of self-reflection after this podcast, then.
Certainly we do, yes. But thank you very much. It was a fantastic and interesting and super insightful episode. Thank you very much for listening and tuning in. And see you in the next episode. Thank you again, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
The Science Basement.
If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up, rate it on the podcast app of your choice, and don't forget to share it with your friends. This podcast was produced by The Science Basement, a science communication organization based in Helsinki, Finland. Interested in being involved or interviewed? Get in touch at the podcast@thesciencebasement.org.